Hi, this is Richard Gere. Did you know there are more Buddhists than Episcopalians in America today? That the Army now hires Buddhist ministers as chaplains. Chances are, whether you know it or not, you have Buddhist neighbors and friends. The following program on Buddhism in the United States weaves a fascinating tale of how this ancient philosophy has come to our shores and how it's affecting American art, literature, and life. I invite you to listen. Years ago, many parts of the world were in a bewildering state of turmoil and upheaval. The technological advances of the Iron Age had wrought not only improved agricultural tools, but more deadly weapons. Peoples of Asia, Africa, and the Mediterranean were almost continually at war as great and changing empires were being built on the rubble of shattered kingdoms. It was a time of violence, uncertainty, and rapid social change. Babylonians, Greeks, Persians, and other powerful civilizations vied for cultural supremacy and land. Long-held tribal values were disintegrating as conquerors overran or displaced millions of people. For many, it was a time of repression and hardship, but it was also a time of creative flowering unparalleled in history, an era of great constructive ideas about unity, morality, and peace. So from the shadows of a very dark age of ancient history, there emerged a dazzling cluster of philosophical and spiritual titans whose seminal genius and influence are still felt by all of humankind to this day. Socrates, Plato, the Hebrew prophets, Lao Tzu, Confucius, Pythagoras, Zarathustra, and Buddha. Siddhartha Gautama, Shakyamuni Buddha, founder of Buddhism, followed today by over 500 million people. Like all historical figures, what we know of Buddha, the man, has been burnished and mythologized over time by loving disciples, zealous reformers, and misguided translators.
To talk about the history of Buddhism is to understand several different things, which is that, like all religions, it is filled and laced with, consistently throughout its history, stories which aren't necessarily true and don't have to be. There are stories that illustrate a particular point, perhaps pertinent to the people who were writing the story or recounting the story at the time. This is true, as I mentioned, amongst all religions, really. If we look at the facts, quotation marks, about the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, we are told that, amongst other things, he entered his mother when she saw a white elephant, that she was in Lumbini's garden, and she reached up to pick a flower, and he was magically born from her side, that when he was born, he took eight steps, or seven steps, and on the eighth step, he said, "I am the one." And every step he took, flowers bloomed forth on the earth. Whether or not this is true or not is not really an issue. What does the story mean? What is the story illustrating? That's the most important thing.
Although there have been Buddhists in the United States since the 1800s, many Americans still are uninformed or misinformed about what being a Buddhist actually means. Like much of the wisdom of the East, Buddhism is at best thought to be exotic and otherworldly, at worst feared as paganism. And yet all the world's major religions have originated in Asia. Christianity, Judaism, Taoism, Hinduism, Confucianism, and Islam were all spawned in the same fertile region. Buddhist words and images are all around us in the West, many entering the vernacular and our consciousness. Karma, guru, chakra, satori, mantra. We have perfumes called samsara, rock bands called nirvana. Yet how much do we really know about what these words represent? Buddhism is one of the oldest and most comprehensive fields of human thought, encompassing philosophy, mysticism, religion, metaphysics, art, psychology, and ritual. For much of the world, the image of the seated Buddha in the state of meditation is as significant as the image of the crucified Christ for the Western world. Unlike Christ, however, Buddha is not thought of as a god, but a guide. He was, in fact, an Indian social and religious reformer who rejected many of the prevailing beliefs of his day. The idea of many gods, the caste system, and the power of the priesthood. Buddhists recognize no creator being, but seek salvation for themselves and others through personal effort and right living. Buddhism teaches compassion and unity with all living things. Buddhist thought and practices have spread from country to country, steadily moving eastward, adapting along the way to prevailing belief systems and customs, profoundly influencing each of the indigenous cultures they encountered.
I guess I've been brought up to see Buddhism as being like tofu.
Buddhist priest Ryo Imamura describes the adaptive quality of Buddhism.
It's a very strange food in that it's very hard to put your finger on exactly what it is, but there are a million uses for it. And if you put tofu in any dish, it somehow blends in with that dish and becomes part of that dish, doesn't violate or take away the integrity of the dish, but also at the same time, still tofu, you know it's there. In the same way, I think Buddhism has a definite character, definite teaching that's timeless and remains true no matter where it goes. It goes on to various countries, various cultures, and seems to make huge changes in its face, in its so-called persona, how it's seen. All the rituals change, the dress changes, the chanting, everything changes.
There are, of course, many, many kinds of Buddhism. Buddhism is 2,600 years old, and it has progressed through many cultures down through the ages, through many different kinds of people, and there are many different kinds of concerns.
Robert Aitken Roshi is the head of the Diamond Sangha in Hawaii.
Mr. Blythe, my first Zen friend, once said to me, there is a person for every religion and a religion for every person. And that's certainly true if you just confine it to Buddhism, because there are devotional Buddhists, there are charismatic Buddhists, there are scholarly Buddhists, there are all kinds of Buddhists. So I think it would be a mistake to generalize in any way about Buddhism, except that it all comes from originally from the teachings of the Buddha Shakyamuni.
As it spread across Asia, Buddhism was propagated by a kind of friendly persuasion rather than by force or coercion.
Buddhism, you know, began in India 2,500 years ago with the waking up or enlightenment of Buddha Shakyamuni. Buddha means to wake up. And then spread throughout the East, to Tibet, to China, to Japan, to Southeast Asia, to Sri Lanka and Burma and Thailand, and developed its own form in all these countries. And got very, in some places, very specialized, very isolated from the other countries. And now what's happening is that all these forms of Buddhism, for the first time in history really, are kind of meeting in America. So it's a very rich, exciting time for Buddhists and for people interested in Buddhism. There's a real dialogue and, you know, kind of Dharma combat, what Buddhists call Dharma combat going on, where you, you know, can challenge each other as to what your understanding is and the nature of the mind. And it's Buddhists are pretty good spirited about it.
All Buddhist traditions, on a fundamental level, speak of the importance of virtue, of not harming through speech, through action, through livelihood, of letting, of having the actions of our life represent the wakefulness and compassion of a Buddha in every moment. Traditionally, these are taught as precepts to follow, to refrain from killing, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from lying, to refrain from abusive sexuality or intoxicants. And those are part of every single Buddhist tradition.
This gentle, pragmatic approach to living began in India 6 centuries before the birth of Christ, inspired by the life and teaching of a prince who left his family and life of privilege to become a wandering monk. Prince Gautama bade a silent farewell to his sleeping wife and newborn son, and rode his horse to the edge of the forest, where he cut off his long hair, exchanged his regal robes for rags, and vanished into the night. In doing so, he joined a whole class of Indian men who, in an attempt to find meaning in their lives, had dropped out of Indian society and withdrawn to the forest to meditate and study. Many left for a few months or years, then returned home renewed. This wandering was, in a sense, a 6th-century way of dealing with what we might now call existential anxiety. Religious life in India at the time was dominated by Hindu Brahmins, or priests. Hinduism and its ascetic offshoot, Jainism, were the prevailing religions of the day. The Brahmins were an elitist cult of priests who performed fire rituals to ensure harmony between their followers and a colorful pantheon of gods. The priests fostered a highly structured social order, protecting their power and status by keeping their scriptures and rituals secret.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And this was said in the 20th century. But 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, realized that when he chose power over himself instead of power over other people, because, as you know, he could have been a king succeeding his father, King Suddhodana, but he didn't do that. He chose to go out and search for himself how he could really have power over himself through enlightenment.
Siddhartha spent long periods alone and naked in the forest. Later he traveled barefoot and begging with 5 companions. He attached himself to one teacher after another, studying yoga and meditation, turning inward, subduing his desires, practicing austerity and concentration. 6 years after he had left his palace, starving and emaciated from fasting, Siddhartha Gautama was near death. He realized that asceticism could not lead to perfection and deliverance, and began to take food again. His companions abandoned him, thinking he had forsaken his path. Far from forsaking his path, he instead decided to seek a new path entirely, a less extreme middle way between the luxury of his former princely existence and the punishing ascetic practices he had endured for 6 years. Remembering a childhood moment of reverie under a tree, he went to the banks of a nearby river and made himself comfortable under the branches of a fig tree, resolving to sit in meditation until he found an answer to the problem of human suffering. He sat all night under the full moon, struggling against his own demons. Buddhist scriptures present this inner struggle in the heroic allegory of the temptation of Gautama by Mara. Mara is a kind of Buddhist Satan, a temptress whose role is to maintain the world of delusion and desire. In the allegory, Mara offers Siddhartha sovereignty over the whole world. Siddhartha repels her. Enraged, Mara summons destroying powers of nature, threatening Siddhartha with destruction. Still, Gautama sits. Then Mara resorts to her most powerful weapons, sending her magically beautiful daughters to seduce the solitary recluse. Siddhartha resists them, and Mara slinks away, defeated. With the last attack of human weakness overcome, a deep peace entered Gautama's heart. As dawn broke, he looked up to see the morning star rise. As he did so, the veil of illusion fell from his eyes, and he saw the world as it really is for the first time. In one brilliant flash of spiritual illumination, the man sitting under the fig tree was no longer Siddhartha, Prince Gautama. No longer a forest sage, he was Buddha, the awakened one. He had attained enlightenment, nirvana, the Everest of consciousness, and intuitive penetration into the nature of things. The essence of this vision, this radical transformation of perception, is difficult to understand or describe in words. Buddhists, in fact, illustrate the limitations of words by likening them to the finger pointing at the moon, reminding us that the map is not the territory. Just what enlightenment means is viewed differently by many individuals and sects. Before enlightenment, draw water, chop wood. After enlightenment, draw water, chop wood, as the Zen Buddhist saying goes. Ani Pema Chodron is an American-born nun in the Tibetan tradition. She describes enlightenment in personal terms.
Buddha, for me, and the way I was, you know, like, taught, doesn't have to do with a person, but actually with the potential of all human beings to wake up, to not be caught in some kind of limited view. Sometimes it's called Buddha nature, but it means that what the Buddha discovered, all human beings can also discover that. It's no one's prerogative, you know. It's no one person or one race or one sex or one anything's prerogative. However, it takes a kind of courage, because it's really talking about exploring your world, your mind, your emotions, with a lot of honesty, also with a lot of gentleness. One's life becomes a process of awakening rather than there's some kind of final goal that you're going to reach or anything like that. Just waking up to the cups and saucers in your life, not to mention the emotions.
Helen Tworkoff is the founder of Tricycle, the first non-sectarian Buddhist magazine.
We don't even know what enlightenment is. Suzuki Roshi once said this wonderful thing about enlightenment. He said to his students, he never liked to answer questions about enlightenment. His students were always asking him, what is enlightenment? How do you get enlightened? He always, if you read the transcripts of his talks, he was always avoiding those questions. And then one day he said, what do you want to get enlightened for? You may not like it.
So it can be seen that Buddhism is not one system of beliefs and practices everywhere understood and practiced in the same way. Indeed, there is no set of beliefs that makes someone a Buddhist. No way of thinking that makes someone Buddhist.
Feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Thank you.
There are Buddhists whose Sunday services, complete with hymns and organ playing, would be hard to tell apart from a Methodist service, just as there are Buddhist monasteries where celibate, robed monks spend their lives in quiet contemplation, temples where students and teachers practice meditation together, married Buddhist priests who minister to AIDS patients, gang members, and prison inmates, Buddhist churches where women ministers take the pulpit. Diversity of expression is an important part of Buddhist doctrine. Some Buddhists emphasize self-understanding through meditation. Others attempt to live simple lives filled with good deeds. Still others practice devotion. Although there is no central authority in the Buddhist world, no pope to regulate spiritual affairs and ensure orthodoxy, all the various traditions share a common framework.
The essence of the teaching is that every one of us has the same essence, the same nature, the same quality as the awakened ones. And what Gautama Buddha discovered under that tree over 2,000 years ago is that's what everyone should know. That's what is everybody's real birthright. Basic fundamental goodness, basic fundamental intelligence, wisdom, some kind of energy that anybody can experience. You're also encouraged to be very skeptical. This view is presented as kind of the basic view, and then the path is somewhat the whole essence of the meditation is, and also of what's encouraged in the study is, do you really buy that? What's your own experience of that?
Minh Duc is a Vietnamese monk.
The essence of Buddhism, in my limited knowledge, is being awake, being aware of what's going on in yourself and outside yourself. The Buddha to me, well, the Buddha is not a god. So Buddha means the one who is awake. So as long as you are aware of what's going on around you, you are the Buddha then. So that's the idea, that's the essence, being awake. Doesn't matter where you live, doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what race you come from, you have the potentiality to become the Buddha. All of us.
Jack Kornfield is both a Buddhist teacher and psychotherapist.
Life is a flow, a movement. And the Buddha spoke of us as human beings as five streams, or five interconnected processes, patterns, if you will, a physical pattern of body that changes all the time if you pay attention. Even on the biological level, all the molecules of your body are replaced every 7 years. This is an entirely different set of molecules, except for a few special neurons in the brain. It's entirely different than it was in 1986 or 87 or whatever. Seems the same, doesn't it? But it's not. The pattern of the physical, the pattern of feelings, the pattern of memory and recognition and kind of how we understand things, the pattern of thought and all our reactions, and then the pattern of consciousness itself that knows these aspects. The Buddha never spoke about people per se, but rather he would speak of the pattern of life that we reflect, that we are.
Lodi Gary, special envoy for the Dalai Lama, spiritual leader for millions of Tibetan Buddhists, describes this practical, tolerant attitude.
The founder of Buddhism, Gautama Buddha himself, have in fact, made it very clear in his teachings that everything must be examined, even his teachings, because he says that do not take anything by blind faith, not because that Buddha have said it, not because any other important religious leader have said it. He said the most important thing is that the human beings must intellectually and analytically examine what Buddha has taught, or what, for that matter, anyone teaches, and only accept and above all practice if you logically and intellectually agree with it. So therefore, I think Buddhism is more a science of mind.
Immediately following his awakening, Buddha experienced a period of uncertainty about whether or not to teach others what he had experienced. Ultimately, he decided he had to share his remarkable insights. He made his way to the deer park near Benares and set forth his doctrine to those who had been his companions in the ascetic life. His first sermon has come to be called The Four Noble Truths. Author and Buddhist historian Rick Fields comments on the Four Noble Truths.
The first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, a Sanskrit word that's sometimes translated as suffering, or as unsatisfactoriness, or this feeling of, you know, they're not being enough, you know. That's inherent in life. And for that reason, Buddhism at the beginning was criticized as being pessimistic. But it's just realistic. That's the starting point, and you have to feel that and see that and not run away from that. Second noble truth is the origin of suffering, or dukkha. That there is an origin to it. And part of the path is discovering for yourself what that origin is. Some people would describe it as attachment or clinging to the idea of a permanent self, or of permanence altogether. And then the third noble truth is the cessation of suffering or dukkha, that when you fully penetrate to that origin, you're no longer caught at the mercy of it. You're no longer blindly turning on the wheel again and again. And the fourth noble truth is the path that leads to that, which is the practice of Buddhism. So that, at least, all Buddhists, you know, they will have varying interpretations, as you would imagine, in 2,500 years and in all these different countries and this sort of conversation going on. But basically, Buddhism is about the noble truth of suffering and the cessation of that suffering.
The five hermits who heard this first healing discourse at Deer Park became the nucleus of the Sangha, or community. They grew up around the Buddha and eventually developed into a large and vital monastic order supported by an involved laity of men and women from all classes. The life of a monk in these early Buddhist sanghas was substantially different from that of other monastic traditions of the day. In sharp contrast to Hindu practice, Buddha encouraged the monks to interact with society instead of withdrawing from it. Rituals were developed that involved the community.